which seeks to provide our listeners with thoughtful, insightful news and commentary from a range of political perspectives on current issues in the U.S. I'm Michael Howe.
And I'm Bob Golden. Together, we'll be reading selected articles from the online news service Tangle. Tangle is an independent, nonpartisan, and subscriber-supported media organization that covers the major political stories in the U.S. Tangle seeks to produce truly non-biased reporting on current events by providing responsible views from across the political spectrum in every single article, clearly labeling that what is opinion and what isn't.
It's important to note that the views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the article authors and publishers and not necessarily reflect the views of the Audio Journal, its staff, or the volunteer readers. With that introduction, let's dive into a couple of articles from the current news cycle. Here's Bob with our first article.
Thank you, Michael. Our first article for today's program comes from the Tangle newsletter of May 19th. The title is The DOJ's Anti-Weaponization Fund. On Monday, May 18th, the Department of Justice announced that as part of the settlement agreement in President Donald Trump versus the Internal Revenue Service, it would create a new fund that could issue formal apologies and monetary relief to individuals and entities who claim to have suffered from lawfare and DOJ weaponization. Anti-Weaponization Fund will receive $1.776 billion from the federal government's judgment fund used to settle and pay other cases. Five people appointed by the Attorney General will oversee the new fund. One of the five must be chosen in consultation with congressional leadership. Backup. In January 2026, President Trump, his sons Eric and Donald Jr., and the Trump Organization sued the Treasury Department and the Internal Revenue Service for $10 billion over alleged leaks of confidential tax information in 2019 and 2020. On Monday, Trump settled that lawsuit in exchange for the creation of the Anti-Weaponization Fund and a formal apology from the government. Additionally, the president is withdrawing two other complaints he previously filed against the government. Administrative claims over the Federal Bureau of Investigation search of Mar-a-Lago in 2022 and an investigation into Russian collusion during his 2016 presidential campaign. The new fund will provide monetary relief to claimants who allege they were politically targeted by the Justice Department under previous presidential administrations. And the settlement creating the fund did not contain any language specifying congressional or judicial overview. Instead, it will be required to report the sum of its disbursements and its recipients to the Attorney General on a quarterly basis. Applicants must choose to file claims, and there is no partisan requirement to file. The fund will process claims until December 1st, 2028, just before the end of President Trump's term. Acting Attorney General Todd Blank cited past litigation such as the Keeps Eagle settlement as precedent for the creation of the Anti-Weaponization Fund. In Keeps Eagle, the DOJ, under the direction of President Obama, transferred $680 million from the judgment fund into a class action settlement fund to compensate Native Americans who were unfairly denied access to Department of Agriculture's credit and loan services. The DOJ press release announcing the fund, Blank said, "The machinery of government should never be weaponized against any American, and it is this department's intention to make right the wrongs that are previously done while ensuring this never happens again." Democrats have criticized this settlement, claiming the Anti-Weaponization Fund is nothing more than a slush fund for the Trump administration's political allies. In a statement, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, said the fund was made to reward his own allies, loyalists, and insurrectionists. Some Republican lawmakers, such as Senator Bill Cassidy, have also criticized the fund. In this newsletter, we'll get into what the right and the left are saying about the anti-weaponization fund. Finally, executive editor Isaac Saul shares his take. Here's Michael with views from the right.
Thank you, Bob. Here's what the political right is saying. The highlights. The right critiques the fund, with some describing it as a more brazen version of the left's past dealings. Some say it takes executive authority too far. Others support the fund as an avenue for redress. In the National Review, Dan McLaughlin said the fund, quote, takes a page from the left's playbook, close quote. McLaughlin wrote, while the fund doesn't stink on ICE quite as visibly as Trump getting the taxpayers to pay him, it nonetheless looks a lot like a collusive operation to create a slush fund to pay off friends and political allies. And in doing so, it expends nearly $2 billion in taxpayer money that Congress never appropriated. The classic Trump modus operandi is to look at something crooked that is done smoothly and quietly through sophisticated lawyering on the left, and then imitate it while saying all the quiet parts out loud. This is another instance. Using legislative appropriations and programs to line the pockets of allied groups is an old standby of Democrats. But so is laundering aid to friends and allies through the judicial system, often with the knowledge that a part of it gets kicked back. Congress should reclaim its authority over large payments made by the executive branch, and our system should also reject collusive uses of the court system when they don't involve Trump. The Washington Post editorial board argued that, quote, the Trump administration is stretching executive authority to a breaking point, close quote. The board wrote, if this stands, it will become a template for all future American presidents to shower financial benefits on friends and allies without accountability. The fund will be under the control of five people appointed by the Attorney General. They can be fired at will by Trump, meaning the money can only go to people the president sympathizes with. The money will presumably flow to conservative figures investigated or prosecuted during the Biden years. But people who are victims of malicious prosecution can seek recompense through the normal legal process. If that process is too onerous, Congress can change the law. The new model of compensation the Trump administration just invented lacks normal legislative and judicial checks. Conservatives rightly blasted the use of sue and settle tactics employed by progressive groups during the Obama administration. Trump is exploiting the legal system in the same way, but the conflict is far more overt because the lawsuit being settled was filed by Trump himself. In PJ Media, Catherine Salgado said President Trump prioritized Americans' search for justice. Salgado wrote, it will be interesting to see how many people take advantage of this fund in the coming months. The Biden administration targeted thousands of people unfairly, from the January Sixers to pro-lifers to traditional Catholics, to Trump allies. To give just one example, former FBI Director Chris Wray admitted to the House Judiciary Committee in July of 2023 that the Biden era spying on targeting of concerned parents at school board meetings was not based on evidence. Representative Kevin Kiley asked Ray if there had been an increase in harassment and threats of violence spurring the investigation into dissatisfied parents who objected to radically woke and sexualized curricula. Ray confessed, "I'm not aware of any such evidence." In other words, that weaponization was purely based on Democrats' ideological opposition to parental rights, not to evidence of violence. Now victims of such injustice have a way of seeking redress. Next up, Bob has what the political left is saying.
Thanks, Michael. This is what the left is saying, the highlights. The left rebukes the fund, with many saying President Trump's actions violate the separation of powers. Some people see the fund as an important example of how Trump maintains his base. Others say it makes upcoming elections difficult for Republican candidates. In the Daily Beast, David Gardner asked, if we cannot rely on America's rule of law, what do we have left? Gardner wrote, by forcing through a self-serving settlement in his $10 billion case against the Internal Revenue Service, Trump has dangerously blurred the separation of powers that has governed the United States through 46 presidencies, including his own first term. The blatancy leaves you breathless, because in Trump's IRS lawsuit, he was effectively both the plaintiff and the defendant. And by manipulating the proceedings, he ended up being the judge. Judge Kathleen M. Williams was reportedly considering dismissing Trump's lawsuit for the simple reason that his personal lawyers were bringing the case and his government lawyers were responding to it. But the judge was rendered helpless on Monday when Trump announced he was withdrawing his lawsuit. Trump has already shown his disdain for the election he doesn't win and the Supreme Court decision he doesn't agree with. Now he is running roughshod through the legal system. And the New Republican, Greg Sargent, suggested the fund might serve as a form of coalition management. Sargent wrote, "This saga captures something essential about how the political economy of Trumpism really functions. It helps explain why his supporters stick by him through one episode after another of the most corrupt self-dealing we've seen from any U.S. president in modern history. For Trump, there is no such thing as justice or injustice. Outcomes reflect power and nothing more. Who is winning and who is losing? Who is dominant and who is supplicant? The fund is overseen by the people who can hand out the loot, and with no transparency, people whom Trump can fire for any reason, say for not giving money to whoever Trump wants them to give it to, including his army of insurrectionists. Payments will keep large swaths of his coalition persuaded that a win for Trump, no matter how illicit or ill-gotten, is a win for them. That his corruption isn't just in his own interest, but in theirs too, because after all, they're getting a cut of the spoils." In USA Today, Chris Brennan said Republicans are stuck with Trump's billion-dollar scams. Brennan wrote, "Imagine being a Republican in Congress right now, seeking another term in November's midterm election as President Donald Trump drops like a stone in public opinion polling, dragging his party down with him. Those Republicans were already going to face questions from voters about Trump's weird obsession with building a $1 billion ballroom at the White House. And now they will have to also justify Trump's creating a $1.776 billion slush fund to enrich his allies who had to face the indignity of being held accountable by law. The war in Iran is at an expensive standstill. The price of gasoline is above $8.50. Inflation is surging again, but Trump is focused only on what really matters to him: retribution and building monuments to himself. Republicans in Congress are handcuffed by Trump and his troubles. We'll conclude this article with Michael reading the Tangle editor's take.
And now, here is executive editor Isaac Saul's take. The highlights. This fund is another overt example of corrupt self-dealing by the Trump White House. Yes, Democrats have been using settlement payouts to advance their agenda for years, but this is different in several key ways. All of this could be legal, but Congress should step in and stop it. A little more than 2 weeks ago, I published a 6,000-word piece exploring all the self-dealing and potential corruption from the first 15 months of President Donald Trump's administration. Had the piece been scheduled for this week, the Trump DOJ fund certainly would have made the cut. It may have even headlined. The arc of how the Justice Department ended up with a cheekily priced $1.776 billion fund for the Trump administration to dole out is remarkable in the worst possible way. In October, the president sought $230 million in damages against the Justice Department for alleged abuses of his civil rights in pursuing partisan investigations into him. Trump actually had a leg to stand on with those initial claims. He was not president when he filed the complaints, and the foundation of at least one of those investigations, the Russia collusion story, was itself the subject of great scrutiny for all manner of violations. There's no need to relitigate it here, but the FBI's investigation into the 2016 Trump campaign was seriously flawed. Suing the federal government is one path towards resolution for the aggrieved party. Of course, the problem is that Trump then became president and continued to not just pursue those damages, but inflate them. A year into his second term, he filed a lawsuit seeking $10 billion in damages for his leaked tax returns. Again, this was a response to a real harm, maybe even a crime. Those returns were leaked, but a government contractor did the leaking and even went to prison for it. Trump sued the IRS itself, claiming the agency didn't do enough to prevent the leaks. The president, obviously, is not the first person to have his tax returns leaked. But here is where things get corrupt and self-enriching. He is the first person to seek $10 billion in damages for that, and he's definitely the first person to seek recompense while also overseeing the Justice Department responsible for doling out that money. Then, when he was staring down the likely prospect of his lawsuit being thrown out of court, because our court system recognized the absurdity of a president effectively suing his own government and then paying himself billions of dollars of taxpayer money, Trump's legal team pivoted. They withdrew their own lawsuit, settled with themselves indirectly, and created the fund to pay out cash to other victims of government weaponization. Now, rather than giving himself $10 billion, Trump has granted himself nearly $2 billion to pay out to anyone who claims the government was weaponized against them. We're all numb to numbers like this now, but I'm still wrapping my head around $2 billion. That's enough money to fund the entire annual budget of a mid-sized city like St. Louis or Indianapolis. You could use it to pay over 23,000 school teachers for a full year, or provide Medicaid coverage for well over 200,000 people for a year. Instead, the roughly $2 billion will be distributed according to the judgment of a board of five attorney general picked people whom the president can fire any time. So the president is in full control of where and to whom the money goes. And he's made it clear it will go to his aggrieved supporters. It feels like a millennium ago when we were debating whether Trump would pardon January 6th rioters. He did, and now he's positioned to give them cash. Some writers on the right have argued that the left has given money to political allies for years. Dan McLaughlin put it like this, quote, "The classic Trump modus operandi is to look at something crooked that is done smoothly and quietly by the left through sophisticated lawyering on the left, and then imitate it while saying the quiet parts out loud," close quote. There's wisdom here, and this is a flavor of something we've seen before. Perhaps most egregiously under President Barack Obama, the EPA would invite lawsuits against regulations it couldn't change, then immediately choose to settle those lawsuits, doling out cash and favorable regulatory changes to get what it wanted while bypassing Congress. Yet the same flavor does not mean the same. A single TOAC chocolate bar can cost as much as $500, but it isn't the same as a $4 box of Cocoa Puffs cereal just because both taste like chocolate. The EPA settled lawsuits for tens of thousands of dollars and altered obscure environmental rules about, say, endangered birds. It's unlikely President Obama was directly overseeing these settlements, but rather turning a blind eye to what his agency heads were doing. Trump, on the other hand, is creating the $1.776 billion slush fund of taxpayer money that he directly oversees and controls, and which he can use to cover administrative services, funds, facilities, staff, travel, and other support services for whatever the anti-weaponization fund ends up going to. The administration and McLaughlin have been using their own counterexample to explain precedent here. The Keepsagel case, which is a case settlement the Obama administration reached with Native American farmers for $760 million. This is not the same flavor, though. That lawsuit was brought over systematic discrimination by the USDA. The plaintiffs went to court, and the settlement was approved by a judge. After all eligible parties received their payments, the remaining amount was then dispersed through grants to the same affected community, Native Americans being denied loans they were eligible for. By contrast, Trump is completely bypassing the judicial and court system by withdrawing the case and creating this fund, ensuring that none of the claimants or harm was reviewed by a judge. This might be the part where you ask, is this legal? And the answer is, actually, maybe. Trump is assessing the federal government's judgment fund, an unkept fund Congress created to allow the Justice Department to settle lawsuits against the U.S. At the same time, Congress has the power to step in and say, the president doesn't get to use $2 billion for a slush fund for his political allies. Will Congress do that? The answer is probably not, since Congress is currently controlled by Republicans who understandably live in fear of crossing Trump and do not seem to care much at all about controlling the purse, reining in wasteful spending, or preventing new presidential absurdities from becoming precedent. Should Congress step in and stop this? The answer is definitely yes. Standing up to Trump's obvious self-dealing is not only a necessity in principle, but failure for Congress to act now will mean Trump just wrote the blueprint for future presidents to do the exact same thing and point back to his administration as the precedent. Now, stay tuned. I'll be back with a second article after a brief pause.
Stay tuned. There's more ahead.
Our second and final article for today's program is from the Tangle newsletter of May 21st. Don't forget about the war in Ukraine. On May 8th, President Donald Trump announced Russia and Ukraine agreed to a three-day ceasefire. Both sides accused the other of violating the truce, and heightened strikes resumed when it ended on May 11th. Over the weekend, Ukraine conducted an overnight drone attack on Russia, including strikes in Moscow, killing at least 4 and injuring 12, according to local officials. The Ukrainian military launched over 1,300 drones in the attack, which Russian state media called the worst in a year. The offensive followed last week's large-scale Russian bombardment that killed at least 24 Ukrainians and injured dozens more. In recent weeks, Ukraine has ramped up its long-range drone attacks against Russia, striking deeper into the country and specifically targeting its energy infrastructure. Additionally, Ukraine's military has invested heavily in missile strikes, targeting sites 30 to 180 kilometers behind front lines, and is outfitted with advanced technological weaponry, including a homemade precision glide bomb. These tools have enabled Ukraine to strike oil, gas, and electricity targets across Russia. Roughly 20 Russian oil export terminals and refineries have been damaged by Ukrainian strikes between April and mid-May. As a result, Russia's crude processing rate fell to its lowest since December of 2009. These developments have raised questions about Russia's dominance in the war it escalated over 4 years ago. Russian forces suffered a net loss of 45 square miles in April, the country's first net loss since August of 2024, according to the Institute for the Study of War. On May the 9th, the Russian Victory Day holiday commemorating the surrender of Nazi Germany, Russian President Vladimir Putin held a significantly scaled-back parade in Moscow. Reports indicated the Kremlin was concerned about security amid heavy Ukrainian strikes. However, some analysts pushed back on the narrative that the tides of the war have turned against Russia. Russian forces maintain control over key parts of Ukraine, and the Institute for the Study of War estimates Russia has gained nearly 30,000 square miles or 12% of Ukrainian territory since Russia's full-scale invasion in February of 2022. Additionally, Western military officials estimated in February that roughly two-thirds of Ukraine's energy production capacity has been destroyed, damaged, or occupied by Russia since late 2025. Since fighting began, Ukrainian and Russian troops have suffered over 1 million combined casualties, while thousands of civilians have reportedly been killed, and the outlook of the war remains uncertain. President Putin, who traveled to China this week for discussions with Chinese President Xi Jinping, said shortly after the victory parade that he thinks the war in Ukraine, quote, is coming to an end, close quote. In an evening address on Tuesday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said, quote, this month has brought a shift in the dynamics in our favor, in Ukraine's favor, close quote, adding the country is holding more positions and inflicting more damage. In this newsletter, we'll hear some perspectives from the political right, the left, and from writers abroad on the state of the war and its most recent strikes. Then, managing editor Ari Weitzman offers his take. Now, here's Bob with the opinions from the political right.
Thank you, Michael. Here's what the political right is saying, the highlights. Many on the right praise Ukraine's use of drone warfare. Others say Ukraine's war efforts offer grim lessons for its allies. In the Wall Street Journal, Tom Tungahat describes the economics of victory in Ukraine. Tungahat wrote, the war in Iran teaches an old lesson about military spending. More than 1,000 intercepted drones roll off Ukrainian production lines every day at $1,000 to $3,000 apiece. The bodies of Kiev-built attack drones are redesigned within months, not years, their engineers even more quickly, and their guidance software within a matter of days. By keeping costs down and rapidly iterating simple technology at scale, Ukraine is delivering a devastating effect. Ukraine produces 4 million drones last year and plans to produce 7 million this year, 10 times its output 3 years ago. For Ukraine, that's the economics of victory. Billions of dollars of weapons destroyed by drones that cost around $2,000 each. The goal is no longer the perfect weapon. You build the best you can, then build it again. 90% is good, or 80% of the cost in 50% of the time. Then do it again and again, 1,000 times more. That not only fills the armory, it creates a system to keep it full. In the American Prospect, Gil Barndollar said, drone dominance isn't the vital lesson of Ukraine. Barndollar wrote, finding enough men to man the 1,200 kilometer front line is a ceaseless struggle for Ukraine. The country has more than 10 million military-age men, but it struggles to find an army of 1 million in the field. Many soldiers are exhausted after years of war without rest. Policy decisions also contribute to the manpower crisis. Fearing post-war demographic collapse, Ukraine still refuses to draft men under 25. Many others have exemptions for critical civilian work, family circumstances, or health issues. The reality is that manpower is still the critical ingredient in war. Absent true machine autonomy, drone tactics don't remove the need for troops. They simply move manpower around. All the attention now being paid to drones and munitions production suggests that war can be undertaken without sacrifice. Ukraine's messy partial mobilization bears witness to the cost of failing to prepare the public for war. A broad loss of trust in the army, widespread draft evasion, and army forced into a war of attrition by its lack of manpower for assault and maneuver. NATO nations, most still wedded to this brittle all-volunteer force model, need to honestly grapple with what a protracted war would demand of their armies and societies. Next, here's Michael with the viewpoints from the political left and journalists from abroad.
Thanks, Bob. First up, here is what the left is saying. The highlights. Some on the left say Ukraine has all but eliminated its reliance on the United States and other countries. Others contend that Europe must now step up to help ensure Ukraine's long-term security. The Newsweek editors argued Ukraine is increasingly able to go it alone. The editors wrote, Ukraine's need for Western capability has given Washington an effective veto over many of the most politically sensitive strike options. And it's not just Washington. Germany has also shown reluctance to give Ukraine its long-range Taurus missiles for similar reasons. Kyiv, however, is gaining strike options that can be launched without a fresh American transfer of materiel. Ukraine's liberating push for self-sufficiency in long-range drones and missiles is beginning to pay off. The military damage from drone strikes near Moscow will vary by target and interception rate, but the political effect is harder for the Kremlin to quarantine because the war is becoming increasingly immediate for Russian civilians. The political question is no longer whether Ukraine may someday acquire a U.S.-approved weapon capable of reaching symbolic Russian targets. Kyiv is already demonstrating that Moscow's defenses can be stressed by Ukrainian-made systems. In Bloomberg, Mark Champion argued, Ukraine is doing better, now it's Europe's turn. Champion wrote, after a brutal winter, Ukraine has managed to stabilize the front over the last few months, on occasion even making net territorial gains. Overall, the nature of the battlefield has changed in ways that blunt Russia's overwhelming advantages in manpower, artillery, and armor. Now, the bloc must agree to a new non-U.S. framework for peace talks and give Ukrainians hope by creating a bespoke path to their integration into the European Union and Western security arrangements. The good news is that most of Europe's leaders by now recognize that integrating Ukraine's large military and drone industry offers their own best security guarantee against a revisionist Kremlin, absent a reliable U.S. partner. Less encouraging is that this war has become a contest of narratives and confidence, as much as a fight over land, so Ukraine's allies must regroup and respond accordingly. They cannot fall for Putin's nuclear threats, which are more a sign of desperation than of strength. For their own sakes, they need to find a new mediator to replace the U.S. and ensure that Kyiv survives what feels very much like Moscow's last throw of the military dice this summer. And now, here is what writers from abroad are saying. The highlights. Many writers abroad say recent Ukrainian attacks have threatened Russian control. Others argue that European countries should prepare to rebuild Ukraine on several fronts once the war ends. In the Washington Examiner, Igor Bondar said, Ukraine has broken the myth of untouchable Moscow. Bondar wrote, long-range Ukrainian drone strikes against Moscow and the Moscow region have exposed something the Kremlin desperately tried to hide for years. Russia can no longer fully defend its own capital. The Ukrainian drone campaign is also exposing a deeper strategic problem for Russia. Modern drone warfare favors cheaper, mass-produced systems over traditional, expensive air defense missiles. Russia is now forced to spend millions of rubles attempting to intercept relatively inexpensive drones. In a long war of attrition, that imbalance matters. The broader point is that Ukraine is steadily scaling up a new model of warfare. The next phase will likely involve coordinated swarms, autonomous medium-range drones, and artificial intelligence systems designed to overwhelm Russian air defenses. Russian authorities already appear deeply concerned about this shift. Panic inside Russia's drone industry has led to investigations, raids, and corruption cases connected to failed procurement programs. Ukraine is dismantling the central myth sustaining Russian President Vladimir Putin's system, the belief that the Russian state remains strong, untouchable, and capable of protecting its own people while waging war against its neighbors. In the National Review, Alexander Kiev and Andreas Umland argued that a coalition must prepare for numerous new challenges once the war ends. Kiev and Umland wrote, "War, not peace, remains the most likely scenario. Yet history rarely ends as expected. Europe cannot afford to be unprepared for the consequences of a sudden ceasefire. Should the fighting cease, Ukraine would not face a simple recovery period, but rather the beginning of a new multidimensional struggle, one that would simultaneously test its security, economy, institutions, demographics, and political cohesion. Winning peace, especially under an imperfect ceasefire agreement, will be just as demanding as surviving the war. Once security is established, economic recovery will be the decisive test. Ukraine's decline during or after the war would grant Russia a belated victory and spur authoritarian revisionism far beyond Eastern Europe. The end of fighting, whenever it comes, will be celebrated by Ukrainians, yet will neither reduce Russian imperialism nor resolve many of Ukraine's accumulated domestic problems. It will merely mean the transition to a new phase of intense political developments whose outcome will continue to significantly impact the future of Europe." And now we'll conclude with the Tangle editor's take. Over to you, Bob.
Thank you, Michael. And finally, we'll hear managing editor Ari Weitzman's take. The highlights. The war in Ukraine has been deadlier than most people can comprehend, and it won't end anytime soon. Ukraine has been forced to adapt its tactics in order to survive. Their adaptation towards small and AI-assisted drone warfare is simply stunning, and I consider to think of its effect on future conflicts. The war in Ukraine is horrifying. Start with the numbers alone. Accurately reporting on these figures is difficult, since both sides inflate the other's losses, but here's a good estimate. Since Vladimir Putin decided to launch an all-out assault to conquer Ukraine by force in 2022, the war has claimed 250,000 to 300,000 Ukrainian military casualties and roughly 1 million Russian military casualties, killed and wounded. Ukraine has killed 8,000 Russian civilians, according to Russia, or Russia has killed 15,000 Ukrainian civilians, according to the UN. Just for comparison, Israel's war in Gaza has killed over 72,000 people. That's not to say one war is more horrific and more important than the other, or to minimize what's happening in Gaza. That conflict is massively asymmetric, and the majority of those killed in that war have been civilians. It's just to try to give some perspective on the number of lives still being lost in this conflict as it enters its fifth year. The war's territorial changes are also rather astonishing. Russia occupies over 45,000 square miles of Ukraine, roughly 20% of the country. Recently, the tide of this war has turned, yes, but it's not a dramatic reversal of fortune. Instead, it is more like a high tide no longer advancing, but starting to slowly recede from the shore. With the help of foreign aid and some foreign volunteers, Ukraine has offered fierce resistance, mostly with its own forces, against the slow, inexorable, steady Russian advance through eastern Ukraine, losing small amounts of territories every month since November 2023. In March, Ukraine pushed the lines back for the first time in years. Then they did it again in April. Not far back, but enough that you could see the past 6 weeks as marking the beginning of Ukraine's own inexorable march to pushing Russia forces out of its country. No peace is coming. Yes, the two sides mutually agreed to a U.S. brokered 3-day ceasefire in a prisoner exchange during the Russian Victory Day celebration. But that peace was tenuous at best. Each side accused the other of breaking the ceasefire terms throughout. And the key disagreements remain. Russia won't accept any peace that doesn't include Ukraine's ceding control over parts of the Donbas region it currently still is defending. Instead of hoping for productive negotiations with Russia, which Ukraine President Vladimir Zelensky famously told President Trump, Vice President Vance, and the entire world would be a fool's errand, Ukraine has adopted a different strategy. Remove Russian soldiers from the battlefield faster than they can be replaced by new recruits. Doing so requires the Ukrainian military to inflict 30,000 enemy casualties a month. And they are succeeding. I consider myself a realistic person. I understand that Russia is relentless, that they've been barraging Ukrainian cities and vital infrastructure for years, unleashing combined missile and drone attacks to deadly effect, and all the while flooding the zone with propaganda. I get that the support the U.S. and NATO countries have given Ukraine have been self-interested and wanting, providing just enough to keep Russia engaged without being decisive enough to drive Russian troops out of the country. I know that given the situation, the existential threat, the relentlessness of the enemy, and the solitary nature of this fight, Ukraine has been forced to adapt or die. That adaption is simply frightening to behold. Ukraine has created a kill zone along the front with a few innovations to existing drone technology. To understand it, you need to know three acronyms. First, FPV, Ukrainian First Person View. Drones are small, cheap aircraft that relay real-time video back to their remote operators. These are different from the long-range drones that Ukraine has been using to attack sites in Russia and terrorize its vast countryside, the ones Russia is now diverting into Baltic countries. These FPV drones are small, fast, and cheap. Ukraine is sending thousands to the front every day at about $1,000 per drone. Second, EFP. FPV drones can be armed with explosively formed projectiles, EFP, which are superheated concave metal plates that, when detonated, transform into solid, fast-moving slugs that can pierce armor. EFPs can easily penetrate netting or wire that troops on the front line use to protect themselves from other FPV drones, and they can even punch through tanks. Third, AI. Ukraine uses artificial intelligence systems to help pilot small quadcopter drones. turning cheap and easy-to-make machines into tools sometimes referred to as slaughterbots. These machines allow FPV operators to identify a target, then cede control to an AI-piloted system, breaking the requirements of a remote human control. Onboard AI makes drones impervious to jamming and allows them to complete the last leg of their killing journey without human control. Videos from FPV drones killing soldiers are easy to find, and frankly, they may be the most disturbing videos I've ever seen. Watching a human being die is always disturbing, and many of the videos of human death are far more gruesome or nauseating. But every video death evokes a feeling of uncanny distance through the screen. It's a facsimile, an experience less than what it is, and more like watching a video game, creating a terrible, alienating feeling of removal. That feeling is grotesquely acute in these videos, warning graphic content, an unsuspected soldier. The drone approaches. He notices it and begins to panic. It accelerates towards him. He helplessly tries to evade, turns to face it at the last second, freeze frame, AI-enhanced image, a face, a 45-year-old, deep lines of hard years ingrained in his startled face, not comprehending its encroaching death. Another face, 35-year-old, 21-year-old. Zoom out, a small explosion. Next video. Let me be as clear as I can. I'm not blaming Ukraine for finding the path it needs to take to win a war it did not choose. We should never forget that Vladimir Putin started this war. He did it because he believes the free nation of Ukraine belongs to Russia, and he can stop the war at any time by leaving the territories he invaded. Ukraine is doing what countless nations and tribes have done throughout history, which is innovate the cold and bloody machinery of war. Here's how one Ukrainian FPV Brigadier Commander put it to New York Times. In a large-scale war, it delivers demons. It unleashes something powerful and accelerates development which otherwise would have taken decades. Or if you prefer, if the international community is concerned about this, then they should have stopped the war early on. The United States, Europe, and NATO should all be glad to see Ukraine assert control again. It would be good for Ukraine to prevail here. But if indeed the tide of war is turning, then it's a red tide coming in. It's very unsettling to be cheering Ukraine's advances in this moment. I unequivocally hope that they can push Russia out, that they can rack up steady gains on the front line, then leverage this success into a strong negotiating position to bring an end to the war. But I also fear the future of war, that the end of this one would bring. Slaughterbots would have seemed like science fiction a year ago. Today, they're actually Ukraine's battlefield strategy. While Ukraine is making concerted efforts to ensure oversight of their AI-powered FPV drones, would every army do the same? A future where Iranian forces remotely crack open a container in the port of Los Angeles to unleash flying autonomous killing machines is no longer a scenario that seems far-fetched. Ukraine is giving us a glimpse of that potential future, and I don't think we're prepared for it.
That concludes our program for today. We hope you have enjoyed listening to Another Point of View, a program that gives a voice to both sides of the debate on current events and important contemporary issues. This program is a production of The Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the article authors and publishers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Audio Journal, its staff, or the volunteer readers. Archived editions of this or any previous program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or by using the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device.
We've been reading original copyrighted material from the news service Tangle with their express permission. Tangle is an award-winning media organization that covers the major political stories in the U.S. It is independent, nonpartisan, and subscriber-supported, with a newsletter read by over 400,000 people in 55-plus countries across the world, and a podcast that reaches hundreds of thousands of listeners every month. Their audience is made up of conservatives, liberals, independents, and those who don't identify with any particular political tribe. Free podcasts can be heard on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. In addition to their free email newsletter, news articles, and podcasts, Tangle also provides a variety of rich subscriber-only content, including special news articles, in-depth investigative reports, and interviews with current newsmakers. To learn more about Tangle and find out how you can subscribe, call the Audio Journal offices at 508-797-1117.
This program is supported by the Worcester Memorial Foundation for the Blind, the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, and from generous contributions from listeners like you. Thank you. Our regular program schedule can be found on our website, audiojournal.org, or a printed version in large print or braille by calling the Audio Journal offices at 508-797-1117. Please remember, we need your feedback. How can we improve the program to better serve you, the listener? Call or email us with any suggestions or general feedback. We want to hear from you. This is Michael Houck.
And I'm Bob Golden. Thank you for listening. We hope you'll tune in again next week. Please stay tuned to Audio Journal. More great programming is coming your way.
Listen to Audio Journal on your smart speaker. Just say, Alexa, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn. Or, hey Google, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn.
This is Bird Note. This young northern flicker is calling from the ground. Sound like trouble? Well, just because a young bird is on the ground doesn't necessarily mean it's sick or injured. At this time of year, juvenile northern flickers are leaving their nests. They fledge when they're 3 or 4 weeks old and almost as big as their parents, 11 or 12 inches long. Although you may picture a woodpecker high on a tree trunk, northern flickers, young and old, actually forage mostly on the ground. So this young flicker, just out of its nest, is poking around in the dirt and leaf litter, looking for ants and other insects. It makes test flights and, day by day, reaches higher and higher into the trees. But you'll still see it regularly, beak down in your lawn probing for food. The best thing you can do for the young flicker, and other fledgling birds too, is to give the bird some space. And especially, keep your cats indoors. Next spring, this bird will probably be drumming on your roof, advertising for a mate. To learn what to do if you do find a sick or injured bird, visit our website, birdnote.org. We'll help you find your local wildlife rehabilitator. I'm Mary McCann. Bird Note's newsletter delivers the wonder and joy of birds directly to your inbox. Sign up at birdnote.org to get a weekly preview of our shows, stories, photos, and more.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.